Welcome to Bible Study for Progressives, a show where moderates, liberals, and leftists of all faiths and ideologies come together to discuss scripture, spirituality, and politics. We engage scripture in its historical context, plumb its depths for wisdom and guidance, and apply its lessons to current events and social issues. Whether you're a liberal evangelical, a New Age spiritualist, a social justice activist, or a postmodern theologian, there's something in this show for you. Come, be energized in spirit and mind to understand the word and what it means to be a spiritual person in today's world. Today's show is Propaganda Alert, Identifying and Resisting Divisive Disinformation. We will first discuss propaganda, what it is, where it comes from, and how we can protect ourselves from it. Then we will examine some recent propaganda around impeachment and the election and expose some of the propaganda we can expect to hear as the election approaches. Our panels include author Bert Newton, media psychology specialist Lisa Snow, and professor of philosophy Joseph Dowd. My name is Rich Procida, and I write on religion and politics for LAProgressive.com, and I have a blog at modernlectionaries.blogspot.com. Let's begin. We are inundated with propaganda. Special Counsel Robert Mueller testified that Russia continues to interfere in our elections, and that other countries, including China and Iran, are targeting us. If that were not enough, there are also domestic sources of propaganda. Domestic sources include political parties, media outlets, religious institutions, and even academia. Professors and scientists can correct misinformation when informed by more complete knowledge, but they are also human beings who are subject to clicks and fads, just like everyone else. We are all subject to the influence of propaganda. We have alt-right propaganda and leftist propaganda. We have establishment propaganda and third-party propaganda. Even advertising is a form of propaganda. What distinguishes propaganda is its deceptive and manipulative nature. The Encyclopedia Britannica defines propaganda as information that is used primarily to influence an audience and further an agenda, which may not be objective and may be presenting facts selectively to encourage a particular synthesis or perception, or using loaded language to produce an emotional rather than a rational response to the information that is presented. The propagandist seeks to change people's attitudes and behaviors through deception and confusion rather than through persuasion and education. The information provided by the propagandist may be true, but it is often just enough information to lead us to the wrong conclusion. The propagandist and his motives are often hidden. Some propaganda is disseminated to the enemy as a means to divide or neutralize the opposition. The purpose of the propaganda may be to simply cause disarray. The propagandist encourages behaviors and attitudes that divide and sabotage the opposition. I find overt propaganda promoted on the right and subterfuge employed against the left. Current Russian propaganda directed toward the United States is designed to cause division and discord both between the left and the right and within the left itself. While propaganda directed toward the right may be overtly nationalist, propaganda directed toward the left is often presented as progressive, when in reality it is designed to distract and undermine the resistance. The propagandists and many of our leaders know they are being deceptive, but the rank and file do not know and come to believe the propaganda. They become disseminators and enforcers of the disinformation. With their self-righteousness emboldened by the emotion-laden propaganda they swallowed, they use peer pressure to force conformity upon anyone who calls oneself progressive. All propaganda comes down from the top. One might imagine that propaganda comes from crazy people who believe weird things, but propaganda comes from governments and leaders. While people certainly come to believe the propaganda, it is the leaders of our organizations and political parties that disseminate propaganda either knowingly or unwittingly. This makes it difficult for people to resist. One important thing people can do when faced with propaganda is to confront it. This allows other people to feel free to question the information too. Many people spread propaganda unwittingly and actually believe the propaganda. Criticism may help to relieve them of their false and dysfunctional beliefs and attitudes. It is difficult and painful for people to accept that their beliefs and attitudes may be influenced by propaganda. It's difficult to accept that what we believe may be wrong, yet this is exactly what is needed. Critical thinking is an important skill that can protect us from the effects of propaganda. Criminal profilers describe mass shooters and people who join hate groups as uncritical about what they choose to believe. It's more about the perceived benefits of being a believer, from belonging to a community to identifying a scapegoat to blame. It really doesn't matter whether the belief is true, so long as it serves a purpose. For example, no one in their right mind in this day and age can actually become a Nazi. Everyone knows that fascism is evil, so why do we still have white supremacists? It's certainly not because of the persuasiveness of their ideas. We are not engaged in an ideological struggle. Ideology, like theology, can be a tool to control people. The struggle is over power and money. Leaders use ideology to cynically manipulate people. I have often experienced this in church when the minister says something and then everyone has to agree. On a larger scale, propaganda is disseminated down multiple channels at once, making it a cause célèbre of the progressive movement, such that every progressive must agree. After all, it's coming down from the top and everyone is saying it, so it must be right. People think that because the information is persuasive and coming from their leaders or some other trusted institution, that it must be true. But it's coming from above because that's where all propaganda comes from, and it's coming all at once because it's being timely disseminated. As the election nears, we will see more propaganda. I want to address some of the propaganda we can expect this election. There is already a great deal of propaganda out there. Much of it is long-standing and regularly repeated. I've identified two ideas that are currently being disseminated as propaganda. One piece of propaganda came down during the impeachment debates and is still being used to demoralize and neutralize the left. This idea is that the Constitution is a document written by slave owners for the benefit of slave owners. This idea is that the Constitution is a document written by slaveholders for the benefit of slave owners and is irredeemable and not worth defending. This neglects the fact that the Constitution is a living document that has been amended and is reread and reinterpreted with each succeeding generation. Added to this is the half-truth that the United States is not a democracy, so that democracy is not worth fighting for in America. You can see how these ideas have been weaponized and used against us. This propaganda prevents leftists from understanding the value of defending the Constitution and fighting for democracy. Always consider the effect that believing something has on one's attitudes and behaviors. It's not whether the idea is true or not. It's whether the idea is being used to manipulate and control people. These ideas are causing many progressive activists to sit on the sidelines in the struggle to uphold the rule of law against a rogue president bent on undermining democracy and instituting an authoritarian dictatorship. The second piece of propaganda I want to talk about is the supposed threat of Christian nationalism. Imagine this. We are in the middle of the campaign for president, when we should be talking about climate change, healthcare, democracy, poverty, and all the other important issues. But instead, we find ourselves in a pitched battle with the right over Christianity. Consider how this works to help Trump. Trump wants to label Bernie Sanders and his supporters as Christian-hating socialists. There is nothing he wants more than to make the election about Christianity. While there may be a thing called Christian nationalism, is it really the threat the ideologues make it out to be? I imagine most evangelicals would scratch their heads and not know what we are talking about. Even if Christian nationalism is a thing, are we really engaged in an ideological or theological struggle? President Trump isn't a Christian and doesn't believe in any of that stuff. He uses words and ideas to manipulate his followers. He wants to paint the left as a bunch of Christian-hating socialists. Don't help him paint that picture. The concept of Christian nationalism may have some truth to it, but it's not the whole story. The pairing of the word Christian with the hated word nationalism appeals to anti-Christian sentiment on the left and operates to demonize Christians. This is the main effect that the mention of Christian nationalism has on progressives. So even if Christian nationalism is a thing, it's not the threat the ideologues make it out to be. It's too complex an issue to be hashed out in sound bites. During the election, we should be focused on other issues. If you think impeachment was a distraction, Christian nationalism is the distraction of distractions. Yet you will see it on television, in the news, in books, and at church. You will hear it on the radio and in leftist circles. It will come from the national leaders of social justice groups and be disseminated at rallies and in classrooms and in speeches everywhere. You may disagree with me on some issues, but be critical about your own ideas. View things through the eyes of the propagandist. Ask questions like, why this and why now? Think about how ideas can be used to divide or neutralize us. In this time of fake news and foreign interference, it's important to think critically about what we believe. We should make it a practice to listen to the views of others without being afraid to confront divisive disinformation when we see it. Don't react emotionally to information and be wary of simple arguments that don't fully support the alleged conclusion. Remember, you're probably not getting a balanced viewpoint. Things are more complex than a simple three-sentence argument can explain. Christian nationalism is not the issue, especially during this election. We do have some degree of democracy in the United States, which is protected by the Constitution, which is worth defending. And yes, democracy is worth fighting for, even in America. So I've been doing some research on propaganda, and it is everywhere, and everyone is using it. And it's amazing to me that people aren't really aware of this, and yet it's a part of the normal art of persuasion. So I wanted to turn to you, Lisa, as a media psychology specialist. What can you tell us about propaganda? What is it? How does it work? How can we protect ourselves against it?
Okay. So propaganda is kind of a narrative. Hopefully I'm not too loud there, Rich, but propaganda is a form of narrative. And narratives are basically just ways in which we string facts and observations together. So at one end, we have scientists who take observations and they come up with an idea of how these different observations might be explained. They come up with a theory that could be considered almost a narrative as far as an explanation for the relationship between these observations. They test the theory with future events to see if that narrative holds out or the theory holds, and then they revise and redo accordingly. That's one end of the spectrum. At the other end of the spectrum, we have propaganda. And that's where people start out with the end in mind. So basically, they start out with what they want to be true, and then they go back or what they want to be true or what they want or what the impact is that they want. And then they go back and construct a narrative that will influence people to agree with what they want to be true. So climate change is a good example. You have climate change scientists on one hand who look at the observations. They come up with a theory based on the observations. They do more observations. They test. They tweak. And they go back. And then on the other side, you have climate change deniers who are often funded by like big oil and people who might have a vested interest in not having climate change concerns addressed. And so they either want to confuse people or come up with another narrative. For example, there's always been change in the climate throughout history and things like that. So they'll point to different facts to try to support their claim. So in that sense, it's kind of a propaganda thing because you're starting with the end in mind. And those are kind of the two ends of the spectrum. And then there's a lot of stuff in the middle that we just use every day to get through our everyday lives. As far as being able to identify it, you want to, one good way of kind of helping yourself not be as influenced by it or understand biases and prejudices is if you compare what two people are saying about the same thing, take climate change, and you look at the evidence and the facts that both sides are presenting. Climate change is a tough one that both sides are presenting. You can start to identify what facts they're using and what facts they aren't. And sometimes propaganda is also created to make a big, bad problem not seem relevant, to talk around it, for example. And sometimes in just aligning the facts that are supporting the different propaganda or the different statements, you can or different theories, you can actually figure out which ones you believe, which ones are most credible. Sometimes it's what they leave out that's more important than what they included. And so I think that's a good way of kind of trying to check yourself and immunize yourself. And I've done that with a number of people, like school prayer. And sometimes you just line up. It's just a difference of opinions and priorities and how different people layer things in as far as the conclusions that we come up with. And we can respectfully disagree. But and that might not be propaganda, but that's a kind of a form of narrative comparison. So I think that's one way to kind of check yourself, try to keep your thinking straight. There's other things I think you're going to talk about later that can awareness of how we can be manipulated psychologically and things like that are also critically important. And one of the challenges, just like a big thing before I turn it back over, one of the biggest challenges is propaganda. There's an asymmetrical power advantage when it comes to propaganda, because it takes everybody a lot longer to sort through it, to find the truth, while they don't have to worry about credibility or accuracy. They can keep spinning it out. And when it comes to social media, propaganda can almost be weaponized in that we are confronted with so much information so quickly. A lot of times we default to psychological heuristics, kind of shortcuts to deal with all of this information. And those shortcuts can actually be exploited, and the effectiveness can be measured very accurately using online statistics. You know, Facebook provides and Twitter provides as far as the response rates and how these messages are traveling. So there's a lot of challenges with trying to immunize ourselves against propaganda, but there are things we can do.
So I think what you're talking about is that cognitive miser. We want to make things easier. Sometimes we don't want to put in the effort, and that's just natural because we're bombarded with information, and we don't want to. It's too much to consider everything. So sometimes we do take those shortcuts. And then also propaganda sometimes appeals to our predispositions, our prejudices, our opinions that we already hold. How does that work?
So that's a very accurate point. And that's something I think the media has become very sophisticated with. First of all, going back to narratives are really important too, because narratives are often confused by people as fact. They're so closely linked to fact, they become confused with fact. And that causes a lot of problems. And media definitely tries to perpetuate that in some cases when it's agenda-driven media. Because once you take a narrative as fact, propaganda can work even easier. Because once you decide certain things are true, the propaganda can be more effective. So, for example, I was just on social media a little bit ago, and people were complaining that people who don't pay taxes or who use social services are just lazy. Somebody on social media was talking about the laziness of people who need social services, that kind of thing. So they've accepted that narrative as fact in their mind. And from that, a lot of other propaganda can become more effective. So they can layer it and layer it and layer it. And that's also challenging. Additionally, a lot of the most effective propaganda networks have convinced people that they're telling them the truth. So they'll constantly repeat that. And they also have convinced people that they're rational, which we're not, at a very fundamental way. We're not rational at all. We get shortcutted by a whole lot of things. But when people are convinced they're rational and reasonable, once they think something is true or they feel something is true, then when somebody contradicts them, they immediately dismiss the other person as being unreasonable or stupid because they think they are logical and true, you know, and accurate. So it becomes, it's a great way if you're spewing propaganda to get people to believe it more readily because their guard is completely down. And they aren't even questioning themselves as far as what they're thinking and why. They aren't having a conversation like this because they know their thinking is clear and true. So there's no reason to consider it. So that's a big thing too.
Advertising is a form of propaganda, right?
Yeah. So advertising, because it's starting out kind of with the end in mind. So we're influenced all the time by media and we're not aware of it. It's so many different levels. That's why I kind of started out with narratives. And then I went to one extreme with the scientific theory and propaganda to the other extreme, because propaganda, advertising's in there. Just our day-to-day lives is in the middle. We see two things happen and we come up with an explanation. But propaganda, you could probably consider advertising to a large extent propaganda, although propaganda sometimes doesn't have a basis in fact. So where advertising has to at least have some constraints legally or they can get into trouble. But it's similar to propaganda in that advertising and propaganda both start with an end in mind and then try to figure out how to get people to think or act how they want to and then work their way back into it to develop the message in the media.
And they also use what's called loaded language or emotional language. I see this I've been going to some groups, and I've actually seen it all my life as an activist, of how the left is so terribly divided. And I think it's divided because of propaganda. I mean, I think if we ask, why is the country so divided? One answer might be propaganda. Why does the left is ineffective? Propaganda. You know, why are we in the situation we're in? It's because of propaganda. So, like this one organization, they'll list a bunch of things that sort of make you unhappy. And I'm thinking about this pamphlet on Christian nationalism, where they just list a bunch of quotes that sort of make you angry. And then they jump to the conclusion that this is a huge threat of some sort, some ideological threat. So there's like a disconnect. It's like, and that might be something that Joe wants to address, but we are emotional beings mostly. And some people, and like you said, we use our ideas, our intellect to argue the positions we already hold. So that obviously happens on the right, you know, with prejudices being applied to, but it also happens on the left. So how does this sort of emotional propaganda hurt us? And then how is the left? Because some propaganda is not like just trying to give you misinformation and confuse you, but it's actually covert propaganda. It's coming from a source that's hidden, and it may actually be propaganda that looks, like I said in my art, looks progressive, but in reality, it's being pushed by a nationalist like Vladimir Putin.
So when you got to the emotional thing, and I think that was probably, that's another good thing to mention right now too, is we often think that, it's a common theory that we see something, we think about what we're going to do or how we feel about it, and then we feel it or we act on it. And so this rational thought happens first. The effectiveness of propaganda and what you were talking about is what actually happens is we see something happen, and it goes through an emotional filter first, not a rational filter. And so we go through the emotional filter first, and fear, anger, and things like that can derail the rest to where we don't get to rational thought and logical outcomes. And propaganda in today's media environment is saturated in the idea of kind of hijacking the experience at the emotional level. So fear is a great one because it really hits people fast. Anger, conditioned anger can be fast too. So to your point, people will feel angry, right? And then they hear the statements that this is a big problem. And if you haven't felt so angry, you're going, these two things don't necessarily connect. There's a problem with this, right? But a lot of people will feel so angry with those statements that they'll jump right into what they said afterwards and be like, yes, that is a big problem. I can't believe this is happening, right? And so you have to watch. That can be kind of even a flag for when you're experiencing or when you're consuming propaganda. When that strong emotional thing hits you, maybe that's a time you stop and sit back and go, wait a second, what's going on here? Why am I feeling this way? And let's look at what they're really doing here and saying here and walk through, does this logically follow? And I think you're going to go into that here soon with somebody else. But does this logically follow instead of just impulsively or emotionally reacting to what you heard or saw or read?
I think you're probably familiar with the term cognitive dissidence.
Oh, yes. That's a whole nother thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Does that play a role in propaganda?
So cognitive dissonance is basically when you have a strong belief and you're confronted with something else that basically is in conflict with that very strongly held belief. And it can create like a lot of mental discomfort. It's unconscious, so we don't really recognize this is why we're reacting to it. It makes a lot of people very angry. But this is also, just to back up one step, this is the brilliance of Donald Trump's fake news. Because Donald Trump's expression, fake news, was a cycle. And I don't think he understood this when he came up with it, but he saw how effective it was. When people would say fake news, and even now when most people say, oh, that's just fake news and dismiss it, what that does is it relieves that cognitive dissonance and that discomfort they're feeling intellectually because they have this strongly held belief, and they're realizing that there's some information out here that doesn't match my belief, and I really want to keep my belief. So by saying fake news, they immediately can just dismiss it and shove it aside. So to some extent, the whole idea of propaganda, you know, like fake news was like kind of a great propaganda technique, because if you've got people believing something very strongly, you can kind of build a concrete wall around that belief system if they also think it's okay to just say fake news and kick everything out that doesn't conform with what they believe. It's very dangerous, though.
In my research, I came across some things about the 7 types of propaganda, or there some have 30 types.
Yeah.
Some have more than 7, but a lot, it seemed to be that there are 7 types. What can you tell us about that?
I'm not sure which ones you're referring to. I might have to defer to you on what you've read specifically, because
well, some of them are like, well, this is, it's the role of peer pressure might play in it, and and there's bandwagoning and other types. Let's see what I got
like
here.
There's social conformity element to that too, that kind of can get into group identity, which all can be leveraged with propaganda. I was looking at propaganda as basically a message, but there is a much larger dynamic at play, the social dynamic, you know, leveraging bandwagon and maybe even embedding that in the message. Everybody knows, you know, that kind of thing. A lot of the propaganda today, I think, is centered around this us versus them thing. So you have people who are not us and them. People have bought into that narrative. So the propaganda is very effective when they create other messages that embed that concept in those messages.
Let me turn to Professor Dowd now. Propaganda often contains what are called logical fallacies, and there are other techniques. And as a professor of philosophy, what can you tell us about this? And what should we be looking for when we're confronted with propaganda or advertising or that?
Okay, well, that's an excellent question. I think before I say anything else, I should point out, you know, we've been talking about propaganda as a negative thing. Now, it's important to keep in mind, depending on how you're defining propaganda, posters reminding people to wash their hands after using the restroom are technically propaganda. Propaganda isn't necessarily a uniformly negative thing. To your question about logical fallacy, well, I think really instead of focusing on specific logical fallacies, and I mean, if you want to find a list of them, just go on Google and Google logical fallacies. There are plenty of resources out there that will, you know, list different logical fallacies like slippery slope, like ad hominem, etc., and explain what those are. I think maybe in the context of the issues we're discussing right now, I think maybe a better thing to focus on than specific logical fallacies is just being aware of the genre and the purpose of a piece of, well, for example, a piece of writing. And I think one problem that we're running into, you know, people talk about how we're kind of living in this kind of post-truth era where, you know, people can't even agree on what's true anymore. I mean, it used to be that Americans could agree on the basic facts. They just had different ideas about what we should do about the facts. Now they can't even agree on the facts. One of the contributing factors here, and I think is the pretty significant erosion we've seen of the distinction, at least in the public's mind, between news articles and opinion pieces. I mean, I see this all the time. I teach at a university, and I see this all the time with my students. I also work at this tutoring center. And one thing I've noticed is students will say, I found an article about a certain topic. And, you know, half the time the article, I mean, it is an article, but it's an opinion piece, you know, from what would be the op-ed section of a print newspaper, right? If there still were print newspapers. I mean, and I don't think this is really the newspaper's fault. I think that, you know, just the fact that everything's online. And if you go to Google News and scroll through, it'll have both news articles and opinion pieces, like, you know, all in the same list. I think really part of this is the effect of the internet, and there are probably other factors at work too. But yeah, I think that's just part of a larger phenomenon we're seeing, with just kind of this erosion in the public's mind of the distinction between between reporting and opinion. And I think so just being aware of that, right? Being aware, like, when you read something online, if it is an opinion piece, then read it as an opinion piece. It might cite facts, but remember, just because it's in some kind of publication, right? And I would say this about, you know, not just about conservative publications, but about liberal, left-leaning, and centrist publications as well. If it is an opinion piece, and I try to do this myself, then it uses facts. Usually, it'll link to an article with facts to support its argument. Well, then you click on those links yourself, and you read the news article for yourself and see whether they support the argument in the opinion piece. So that's one piece of advice I would give. Another thing is just to be aware of where something is coming from. And, you know, on a certain level, I feel like I don't really need to say this nowadays, because we're so polarized, your average kind of politically aware person, whether they're right-wing, left-wing, or whatever, they, in their mind, they've probably segregated media outlets into liberal media outlets versus conservative media outlets. So people are, I think, almost over-aware nowadays of where information is coming from. But what I would say is whenever you get some an extra bit of insight or an extra bit of information about where information is coming from, you know, don't ignore that. You know, that's a great gift to you. Pay attention to that and use that. So, like, for example, I've noticed that YouTube has started on its videos, like, whenever there's some kind of major media outlet posting YouTube videos, like news outlets like Al Jazeera or CBS, YouTube has started to put little notices under videos from news outlets about, like, what the news outlet is and who's funding them, where most of their funding comes from. That is very important information. So whenever you do get a little extra information about where something is coming from, pay attention to that. So that's my second, I guess, piece of advice.
Yeah, well, I wanted to clarify that I write opinion pieces. So this article that I just read is an opinion piece, but I try to be educational about it too. And I think this show is about educating people as well. So, but sometimes propaganda doesn't use that. So in some sense, it's hard for me as a lawyer. I realize I use these techniques in, even when sometimes I ignore the facts that I don't want to talk about when I'm writing a brief, because there's nothing good to say about them. So just fair warning, this is a opinion piece that I wrote. But,
oh, well, yeah. One thing you mentioned, you asked me before the show began if I might want to say something about signifiers. Now, did you mean that in, like, Zizek's sense of signifiers, or what were you thinking of?
Yeah, I was thinking that Zizek has signifiers, and they're very similar to symbols, and symbols actually can be propaganda, even things like the cross. And sometimes this propaganda fills in, like, sometimes the propaganda doesn't really say anything, like "Make America Great Again." It's not really saying anything. People are putting their own meaning into it. So do signifiers play a role in propaganda?
Well, certainly. If we're talking specifically about how signifiers are sometimes used within certain corners of academia, not actually academic philosophy all that much, like philosophy department. You find this, I think, more in, for example, literature department, maybe some other humanities and social science departments. But yeah, there is this French, or there was this French psychoanalyst named Jacques Lacan, and the concept of signifiers is pretty important in his theorizing. I'm not an expert on him. Slavoj Žižek also likes to, he likes to draw on Lacan's work, and so he talks about signifiers as well. But now, as I said, I'm not an expert on Lacan. I will say that, I mean, it's easy to kind of overinflate what Lacan talks about because he uses very, very fancy language. But, I mean, it's important to understand a signifier for Lacan is, it's just a word. That's what signifier means. A signifier is a word. So basically, according to Lacan, once we learn a language, we think in words, in the words of that language. Whether this is supported by the empirical psychological evidence, I'm not sure, but that's his theory, that we think in words. And so the system of language, the system of signifiers, of words that we're using, it shapes the kinds of thoughts that we can have, and it limits the kinds of thoughts that we can have. Now, there's also this idea in Lacan that signifiers are kind of their meaning comes from their relationship to other signifiers. So it's kind of like this, your signifiers are this giant web. But then you run into this problem of, it's kind of like if you try to define a word using a dictionary definition, well, the problem is that dictionary definition itself consists of words, so you'd have to define those words, and then you have to define those words. And so in the same, and then you wonder, like, okay, so we've defined all the words in terms of other words. Where does the actual meaning come from? Like, so you get the same problem with Lacan. So if each word's meaning is only a function of all the other words, then where do any of the words get meaning to begin with? And I think that's where Lacan brings in what he calls master signifiers. Oh, I have to confess, I don't completely understand what master signifiers are supposed to be, but for Žižek, at least, he talks about master signifiers, and I think for him, master signifiers are kind of like the big words that hold a lot of kind of symbolic significance for a society, for whatever society uses that language, uses those signifiers. And so I thought of this because, you know, you were mentioning earlier how you were saying, and actually I haven't seen too much of this propaganda myself, but you were talking about propaganda directed at the left that kind of make leftists think that, like, American ideals aren't worth fighting for because of nasty history behind some of those ideals. But you're talking about that, right?
Right, right.
Yes. Yeah. So I when you mentioned that, I thought of signifiers because, you know, I think you made an excellent point that, and I think there are certain signifiers, certain words that have a significance, and you might even say a trajectory, a direction. They're headed in a direction that goes beyond what the original coiners of those signifiers, the original creators of those signifiers, had in mind. So take, for example, the phrase in the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal. Okay, now, of course, the Declaration of Independence, it doesn't have any legal force anymore, but it is an important historical document, and it says all men are created equal. Well, of course, we all know from history class, when at the time when the founding fathers said all men are created equal, when they said men, they meant white, landowning male, right? So it wasn't all human, okay? But here's the thing. Even though the founding fathers did only meant white landowning men when they said all men are created equal. That phrase, all men are created equal, that had a kind of power that went beyond what the founding fathers realized when they used that phrase. People started asking, well, okay, so if all white landowning males are created equal, what about all white landowning males and non-landowning white males? What about people of color? What about women? Okay, and so you see how there are certain words and phrases that have a power that goes beyond what their creators intended. And so I think that's one argument that people on the left should definitely consider before they kind of toss out, you know, say the Constitution as not being worth defending. Now, I mean, I don't think that line of propaganda would be too effective on most leftists, because I think most leftists are sufficiently hostile to Trump that they'd want to, you know, defend the Constitution, at least to the extent of getting rid of him. But yeah, and any leftists who might be swayed by the argument that, well, the founding fathers were all slave owners and they were actually pretty bigoted by modern standards, so we shouldn't believe in their ideals. Well, I mean, those folks should take into account what I just said, that a lot of these ideals have a power that goes beyond what the founding fathers intended.
And one of the things you said earlier about knowing the source, if we've created laws, advertising laws, and also laws on revealing the funder of campaign ads, and those are very important things. And I often use them a lot when I'm voting. Now, I may be prejudiced. I think I know what the groups are about and what this group is about, and I can make a decision on which side I support. And so that's very important. And I don't know, because you've talked about this, but what I want to do as an academic, I mean, I said something in the article, and I find it, I mean, right now I may be dealing with the more extreme groups on the left. For example, while you might think that most leftists would be anti-Trump, you got the Bernie Sanders people were very lukewarm on impeachment. Poor People's Campaign didn't want to move forward on it. And then there's this group, the PSL, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, who does not want to confront Trump on anything. And I think that's because they're infiltrated by Russia. So you've got the communists who are infiltrated by a nationalist leader. And I think that's where we get some of this propaganda that ends up dividing the left. And it's amazing how far it goes, because even in academia, I think it comes down. I mean, I've read some of the stuff on Christian nationalism. I've gone to some of the critical studies stuff, and we had this evidence that critical studies is sometimes not very academically rigorous, or that they're just using certain language in certain articles. There was these three people who had three professors who had written articles, and they had purposely written these articles to show that there are no real standards in some academic journals, and you know how hard it is to get published. And then, yeah. So they said they found that one wrote just kind of a rewrite of Mein Kampf. The other wrote something about dog parks and dog humping and abuse against women. And another talked about how you should abuse white men in the classroom in order to let them know what it was like, or something like that. So as an academic, does propaganda sometimes get promoted through the academy?
Oh, sure. I mean, okay, so I think there are a few different things we need to tease apart here. Is academic work and even teaching shot through with propaganda. Yes, I will say that, but I say that and also add that in certain respect that's inescapable. Because as a, like, let's say I'm putting together a lesson on some subject. Well, I can't talk about everything. That's like, I don't have enough time. So I have to select what I want to share. And I mean, I'm not necessarily trying to promote a certain political view or a certain moral view, but I do have to figure out, okay, what's the narrative I want to tell? What's the story I want to tell these students when I'm picking the facts that I want to put together? Okay, so in that sense, it's inescapable. In another sense, okay, so you were talking about what's sometimes called critical theory. And yeah, I've heard about the same kinds of incidents you were talking about. Some of them are more compelling than others. I mean, there's one case that's kind of the one that started it all. It's called the Sokol affair, where this guy, Alan Sokol, who was a physicist, and a leftist. He was a socialist of some kind. He felt that the kind of the so-called left-wing politics or arguments that were going on in critical theory were just like, he thought they were just vacuous and not rigorous. And so, yeah, he published a parody article in this journal called Social Text, which was for critical studies folks. And yeah, he wrote a deliberately bad article and got it published there. Now, okay, so the trouble I have with that case is that Social Text did not have a peer review system. And they stated they did not have a peer review system. So, I mean, obviously, if you don't have and they thought they were doing a good thing by not having a peer review system because this would allow more freedom for people with unconventional ideas, I think there might be a place for that. But obviously, if you have a journal that doesn't have peer review meaning when they receive a manuscript for an article, they send it to some anonymous expert to have it vetted. If you don't have that for an article, of course, nonsense is going to end up getting published. So I actually didn't find the original Sokol affair so compelling. There have been some other cases where, yeah, it has been kind of an embarrassment for critical theory. I'm not really part of them though, so I don't know it from the inside, and I don't have that much insight into them.
About sources again, if for example Fox News used to and probably still does publish tons of articles, certain newspapers, on immigrants who commit crimes. Now, that's the fact that these immigrants did commit a crime, the ones they're reporting on. But that's not the message they're trying to send. By repeating it over and over again, they're trying to send the message that immigrants are criminals, just like Trump explicated that immigrants are criminals. And you can see that might be sort of a loop. I mean, Trump accepts the propaganda and then spews it out. And then it just gets rehashed and rehashed. So it's very important to look at these news articles critical, because a lot of news articles are opinion. And also some news articles I've learned in research are actually written by people who work for the interested parties who are seeking to spread a certain message. And that goes to climate change, that we may get a news article or a news program and not realize that it's actually written by a lobbyist. So I want to turn to Bert now. As a progressive Christian minister, I think you've heard of Christian nationalism. And as I said, it may be a real thing, but it's not something I think we should be focusing on during the election, especially when we know that Donald Trump would try to divide the country over religion. What are your views on this?
Yeah, well, I think like you, I've heard of it. I don't know any Christian nationalists myself, but the idea that Christianity becomes sort of a cultural thing, and it becomes associated with Western culture or maybe even the United States or white supremacy. And I think, strictly speaking, I think that's a pretty marginal movement. But you did have 81% of white evangelicals voting for Trump, who's very, nationalist, who just really pulled the nationalist, emotional strings to get them. And, I haven't always lived in California. I lived in the South for a while, and I did encounter quite a bit of that type of Christianity that people just conflate Christianity with conservative morality and patriotism and sort of right wing. But what I've seen is a lot of pushback on that, like on social media. At least what I see is people, if not reclaiming Christianity itself, at least pointing out that Jesus is pretty much at odds with this. So I was thinking of these memes that come around once in a while. Like this one I'm about to read is one that's, it's a little bit dated, it's years old, but it says, Obama is not a brown-skinned anti-war socialist who gives away free health care. You're thinking of Jesus. So I've seen a lot of that kind of pushback, and a lot of articles written even in the Atlantic and places like that where people are pointing out, that Trump is not a Christian and that people who support him are supporting someone who is pretty much antithetical to the values of Christianity or the values of the gospel. In my current job right now, I'm organizing faith congregations around affordable housing and homelessness. So I'm sort of maybe a little bit of a bubble right now where I'm associating with people with progressive values and very pro-human and pro environment values and what you might call progressive values, who are also people of faith, mostly Christian faith. So I haven't been running into too much. I've run into as much anti-Muslim sentiment on the left as I have anti-Christian sentiment on the left in recent years, because there's a type of, Bill Maher, and I actually have someone I know that's like that, or he was for a little while, who's on the left, but just really has it in for religion in general, but really has it in for Islam. I know there are people on the left that just hate Christianity, but I don't know. I haven't really run into people that hate Jesus. I mean, there's a few intellectuals that don't believe he ever existed or something like that. But
yeah, I've just run into it a little bit because I was working with the Poor People's Campaign in Santa Ana, and then the leadership came down with that. And it may have been because I don't know if it's because I was saying I'm a Christian, and they decided, well, they were going to come back and educate me about how bad Christianity is. And then with this other group, Refuse Fascism, the same thing happened to me. And I read a little bit about the leader and his negativity towards Christianity. But I think we should be welcoming Christians. And I think your proposal is exactly what we should be doing. We should be welcoming and pointing out how those Christians who are sending the rich, feeding the rich, demonizing the poor, sending the refugee away, sending the stranger away, that they're not in accordance with Scripture. And in that way, we enter into a conversation with them in which we have a shared story or shared narrative or a shared book. And that is a more of a confrontation to them in an area maybe where they might be willing to listen more than if we hit them over the head with socialism or something like that.
I'm surprised that the Poor People's Campaign, seeing as that Reverend William Barber, Disciples of Christ minister, is sort of the front man for that. They would be so, and a lot of it's been organized through churches. But maybe where you are sort of gotten away from that or something.
The group that I was in was the Poor People's Campaign contained a lot of socialist atheists and liberals who are just negative towards Christianity and are resistant towards it. I think we need to also recognize, and I don't know anything about William Barber or anything like that, but some leaders are not really good. I mean, they may seem good on the outside, but what they're really planning, and I've been looking into this, for instance, the Iraq War, I saw a video in my research showing that, or at least arguing, that they didn't have, Bush and his administration didn't really believe there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, but they spent months preparing this. So some of our leaders are using techniques, advertising techniques, propaganda techniques, and manipulating us. And they may be the leaders that we're actually following. In fact, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the propaganda that has come out recently.
Real quickly, Rich?
Yes.
So when it comes to the backlash of Christianity on the left, I think that's one of the important things about what you're doing with the Christian left, because the Christian right for so long seemed to be speaking for all Christians in a very intolerant sort of corrosive way. And so I think some of what you're experiencing on the left is kind of a backlash to that, because they've just had enough of it, just basically fed up to the gills. I think that that's probably what you're sensing, and that's probably why it's important for other people to speak out, and they finally are. But it just took a long, long time. I didn't start seeing it happen until into the Obama administration to any large extent, and it was kind of getting more ramped up towards the end of it. And now with Trump, people are speaking out much more. I definitely think it's a backlash to the hypocrisy and intolerance and everything people just saw on the right.
I have some weird theory that Obama was the reincarnated Abraham Lincoln and Hillary Clinton was his Secretary of State, C-word, or I think that he was Secretary of State. And Trump is the reincarnated Andrew Johnson. Now we got to figure out who Ulysses S. Grant is. So I think it may be Bernie, maybe Warren. I'm not sure. I don't think it's Biden, but after that backlash, after the Civil War, there were three Republican administrations. And remember, the Republicans were basically the progressives at that time. So I'm hoping that pattern follows it. And then I may see how it works for the rest of my life, see if every president matches with that president. But
just real quickly, too, just to inject, you just actually demonstrated how we put together narratives absolutely perfectly by taking, you know, these different pieces in history, right, and putting them together a certain way to put together an idea of what could happen in the future or to understand what's going on now in a context that's different and, you know, may or may not make sense to you, right? But that's exactly, we're like storytelling people. And I just wanted to stop and point that out because that's like an excellent, perfect example of how we all do this. But you just did it right here in a creative way.
Awesome. So now just two little things that maybe we can talk about a little bit. One thing, we talked about cognitive dissonance. And how sometimes propaganda is used. And it's important for us to see that propaganda is not just coming from the Republicans. It's also coming from the Democrats. So there was this idea that Bill Barr's letter messed everything up. And my thinking on that, because I don't know and I do not believe that there's a single progressive or a single Democrat who was fooled by Bill Barr's letter. There were, obviously, if somebody's a Trump supporter, they're fooled by Trump. But for as far as liberals and progressives, I don't think anybody was fooled by Barr's letter. But it created cognitive dissonance because here Trump had violated the law, violated the Constitution. the Democrats are supposed to stand up to a president who violates the Constitution, who is a threat to our democracy, and all the other things he's done. And yet they didn't do it. So people are stuck with this cognitive dissonance. Are the Democrats actually going to protect the Constitution and fight against Donald Trump? Or why didn't they do anything? And so everybody had different explanations. One guy said, oh, it's going to be because Nancy's just playing a game where she's trying to pretend she doesn't want to do it, to be dragged into it. But I believe she didn't want to do it for the very reasons she stated. But everybody sort of said, oh, Bill Barr. So now we know who is responsible for the Democrats' failure to act. It's Bill Barr, and it's all just to cover up in their minds the fact that there just wasn't the political will to prosecute the president at that time. What do you think about that?
My thought on it is right now the right has a very powerful media, organized media network and propaganda network relative to the left. You know, there's propaganda on both sides, but one has been more organized, they're more honed, they're more disciplined. You know, they were like a machine going back to Bush Jr. when he was president back in the early 2000s. It was remarkable what they could do. Now, Trump actually makes it less efficient because he won't stick to the script and he plays off the cuff, but there's still elements that are extraordinarily powerful. And the left, by contrast, has nothing like that. So, you know, Trump says no collusion, you know, whatever. He's got his three or four words or whatever, and he says it over and over again. You watch what people on the left say, and it's like a paragraph, you know, it's like on and on and on they go. And so it's hard for news to handle it. It's hard for other people to handle it. And just what are you trying to say in a snapshot to combat what he's talking about? And I just don't think the people on the left are as organized. I don't think they get it. It's about communication. So I'm not even talking about lying. You know, I'm not talking about like propaganda per se. It's really about being able to communicate effectively to get your point across. And they just don't get it at almost every turn. And when it comes to strategy, you know, they should have been saying through this whole Biden thing, every time somebody was asked about it, every single Democrat should have just said, I don't know why you're asking. Basically, they should have said, why would Biden testify? This is about Trump and his actions. Done. They ask you the question 15 times. You say the same thing 15 times. That's it. Turn it back on Trump. It's done because it's true. Right? That's the fact of the matter is that's just the communication. I watch Biden go on and on and on and on for minutes about it. And that's all they needed to say. So they can't compete against that. I mean, Trump, they just get beat up in the media. The senators are all scared because they don't want Trump to turn on them. But if Trump turns on them, the media is going to turn on them. And that's a whole other thing. And so the senators are obviously scared and concerned, too. The left doesn't have anything like that by comparison, again, as disciplined and as well-financed and funded. So I just think they just didn't have it together. Nancy Pelosi knew that's what she was going up against. Maybe she wouldn't admit it, but you can't go up against that with the, you know, with what they have and the tools they have. So I think they got to the Ukraine and then they had something they could try to make very simple and very concise. And they still didn't do a great job with it, but they could at least make it simple and people could understand it. Sorry, that's it.
Oh, that's great. How about you, Joe? Did you want to jump in or?
Oh, sorry. I just thought of something that I think is important, sort of inspired by what Lisa said. Lisa was pointing out kind of the problem that the left has. And this is not, people have been talking about this for a long time. Like Lisa, I'm sure you've heard of George Lakoff, right?
Oh yeah, there's George Lakoff, and there's Luntz on the left, but for communication and words. But yes, oh yes, George Lakoff, exactly.
Yeah, and so I thought of it. But anyway, I was listening to what you were saying, and I think, you know, one piece of this puzzle, and it's uncomfortable for me to say this, but I think one of the reasons why the left is having all the problems it's having right now. It essentially stems from the kind of the takeover of the left by, well, people like me, basically academics. Yeah, academics. I was about to add intellectuals, but that's not right. I mean, we want intellectuals to be leading any kind of movement. But just the way that the kind of the center of left-wing organizing has kind of shifted to essentially the university campus. People don't really remember this, but there was a time in American history when the kind of the white working class, which is now kind of notoriously, at least in the popular imagination, notoriously kind of right-wing, there was a time when there was almost scarily left-wing people within, you know, the labor movement and all that kind of thing. But people forgot that. And I think part of the shift that's happened is, yeah, the center of left-wing organizing has shifted from, you know, the union hall to the academy. And I mean, maybe that was inevitable. I mean, I don't want to blame anyone in particular for that, but I think one effect of that, the problem with that, is that no matter how knowledgeable and intelligent an academic might be, academics in general just are not good communicators. You hear how I talk on this podcast. I drone on and on and on. That's how academics talk. They are actually very bad at sound bites and stuff like that. And so I'm not sure if I really had a specific point here. I just think, yeah, one of the pieces of the puzzle here is just the way that there perhaps is kind of an overrepresentation of academics within left-wing organizing.
To your point, and since you mentioned Lakoff, exactly, I heard him speak maybe a year or two ago, and he made that exact point. I'm not sure if you had heard him say that, but he basically said that Republicans, when it comes to universities, Republican kids and stuff like that, they go to business school and learn about marketing. And yeah, the kids on the left, they're in philosophy and, you know, literature, and they're in all these other majors. And so basically, when it comes to marketing ideas, communication strategies and things like that, which are really basic, the GOP has it down and the left does not. Yeah. It's just tragic, because going back to the whole Biden thing, Biden could have ended this back in November if he just said, I understand the situation with my son looks bad, and as president on day one, I would propose legislation for transparency so that the kids of all representatives, or, you know, everybody in the cabinet, everybody in my cabinet and everybody else, all close relatives, would disclose their business interests moving forward for the sake of transparency, right? And then he could have pushed it back on Trump and said, and I understand Trump thinks this is important, look at what he's putting this country through. I would hope that he wouldn't wait for the election, and that Trump himself would propose similar legislation that would require, like, the kids and close family members of people in his administration and cabinet also list and disclose all their financial interests. You know, say it more concisely, have it lined up with Nancy Pelosi, so she has legislation sitting there, and say, Nancy Pelosi has some draft legislation. Now Trump has a big pile of conflict of interest sitting in his lap, because his kids are doing way worse than what is accused of, what Biden's kid is accused of.
Right.
You know what I mean? But you turn you stop the conversation right there, and you just say, you know, I understand it may not look good. As a result, this is what I would do, and then turn it back on Trump and have everybody asking Trump, wouldn't you support that legislation if you're so concerned about this appearance of corruption?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
We could have been done with some of this discussion a long time ago and put that to rest, you know, if that's the answer. If Trump is so serious, then he can sign the legislation. Why is he not doing that? If Trump is so serious, why isn't he doing this? And move it over and on to something else. And instead, it's just like, no pun intended, because it's Groundhog's Day, but it's Groundhog's Day. We keep circling through with this over and over. So anyway, so I think that's why Nancy Pelosi didn't do it, because she couldn't do it, because she didn't have the communication, the strategy, the message points already prepared in the minds of people to where they could accept the battle. And instead, they would just get bludgeoned by right-wing media because it's pretty aggressive.
That's an excellent point. This has been Bible Study for Progressives. If you enjoyed the program, please subscribe to our podcast or put us in your favorites and write a 5-star review. Tell your friends about us and share us on social media. Follow us on Facebook and click the donate button at modernlectionaries.blogspot.com. Your support will help us reach more people, produce more and better shows, and cover the cost of production. Feel free to send me a note or comment on the show. I would love to hear from you. Until next time, this is Rich Procida. Thank you for listening.